Hey everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast. Welcome to episode 109, how hail causes damage and how we can reduce it with IBHS. When we think about destructive natural hazards, we often think about high-profile events like hurricanes, tornadoes, or blizzards. Much farther down the list is a hidden hazard that cumulatively inflicts massive losses, but does not often make headlines. The hazard we're referring to is hail. According to IBHS, the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, annual hail losses in the United States routinely exceed $10 billion. IBHS has attacked this problem head-on by funding teams to research this hazard in the field and conducting lab experiments at their facility in South Carolina. This episode features an interview with Brenna Meisensahl, a meteorologist and researcher at IBHS, and Sarah Hudson, a meteorology student in her final semester at Virginia Tech University, who worked as an intern with the IBHS Hail Lab. Brenna and Sarah, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Thanks for having us, Hail. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Well, today we're talking about hail, and it's interesting. If we were to list weather hazards that make the news or that people get worried about, we'd see hurricanes and tornadoes and blizzards and wildfires, and hail would probably be near the bottom of the list. But you and your team have found that building better to mitigate against hail damage is extremely important. Brenna, let's start off with you. Why is that so important to consider hail damage with the built environment?
Yeah, you do typically see tornadoes or hurricanes really making the news and stuff, but hail surprisingly actually can cause 60 to 80% of damage from severe weather, which folks might not know that. I know I didn't know that really growing up, and then coming here and at IBHS and being a meteorologist, you start to learn that. And it actually can cause billions of dollars. So last year we hit $53 billion in insured losses in the United States, which is actually second to 2023, which was $58 billion. So it's definitely an area of research that we really focus on because of how much loss and how much damage it causes.
I mean, that's tremendous. Do you think part of it is because there are like often little thunderstorms scattered around the country on any given day in the spring and summer? And so they're not going to make headline news, but cumulatively, it sounds like they have a lot of impact.
Oh, yeah. Hailstorms tend to be more localized. If you check out SPC and you see the severe weather outlooks, you can get storms across the plains and small, discrete little storms, but they can cause a lot of damage.
So let's talk about hail size. As you mentioned, the SPC, the Storm Prediction Center that NOAA runs out of Norman, Oklahoma. It's amazing the forecast they do, the daily reports for severe weather. And we see they'll actually mark the location of observed hail, but also the size. So we know that hail can range in size considerably. At what sizes do we start to really see substantial damage to the built environment?
So hail, you can get damage from hail in all sorts of sizes. Even small, subsevere, your pea-sized hail, those can be damaging, more in terms of granule loss if you're looking at asphalt shingles. And it depends on the concentration. Your higher concentration of hailstones, you're going to likely have more damage than you will smaller concentrations. But those larger hailstones, of course, can be more damaging. That you get different damage modes where you get dents and cracks and tears in your shingles.
So it sounds like even surprisingly small hail can have an impact depending on the types of shingles. Well, and then we also know there's a lot of impacts to vehicles, to other things. In fact, Jeremiah Long, our senior video producer, is behind the scenes today. Jeremiah, if you want to pop up some of those pictures, IBHS sent some pictures of hail damage that we saw, you know, both to the built environment, to vehicles. And it's really interesting to see these impacts on the ground and the damage on the ground as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And hailstones, like you said, can range in all sorts of sizes. Like I talked about, subsevere. Actually, our largest hailstone record is 8 inches. And it's actually the world record, too. It's not just the U.S. record. It's 8 inches. It was found in Vivian, South Dakota. It's termed as the Vivian hailstone. I actually have a 3D print of it here, so I can kind of show you guys and the viewers of how big that stone actually was.
That is enormous. I mean, that is huge.
It's probably almost the size of my head, or maybe just about a little bit smaller.
Wow.
But yeah, so this is an insanely large hailstone.
Yeah.
This was found in 2010. So it's been a while since maybe we've had a larger hailstone, or at least anything that could beat this record. I know Texas, the Texas record is just about 6.5 inches in diameter.
Yeah, I think there was that big one up by west of San Antonio several years ago. But for those of you not watching online, Brenna just picked up. It's way bigger than a softball. It looked like, I mean, this, like you said, it's almost as big as your head. It's hard to imagine that falling out of the sky, and we can get the idea of why that would cause so much damage.
Yeah, and typically when you have large hailstones like this, you're not getting a high concentration of them by any means. They're more on the rarer side, absolutely. And it's probably a couple of stones here and there in an entire storm that are actually larger. Most of them are going to be small, maybe 2 inches and below.
Brenna, you talked about this world record hailstone in South Dakota. You mentioned the one in Texas is over 6 inches. So we're talking about the plain states here. I mean, in general, what's the geography for really big hail? Is it generally in the U.S. plains? Can it extend outside that zone? Where are we looking at for the main target areas here?
Yeah, we've typically seen larger hailstones across the plains region. We do get hailstorms in the southeast. That is another region that we tend to investigate. Those tend to be a bit smaller, more high concentration of maybe subsevere 1.5 inch hailstones. It's surprising too, even up in Midwest and the New England states. Like, I'm from Rochester, New York, and I remember hail when I was growing up, but it was not something that we typically saw. But it was more pea size. You're not really going to get large hailstones up in that area.
So generally, you may see some severe weather, you may see some hail, but generally fairly small hail in maybe the northeastern states, Great Lakes, things
right.
like that.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Yeah, Brenna, I thought it was really interesting when you lifted up that hailstone. I could see not only is it enormous, but it also has some jagged edges to it. You know, this does not look just like a perfect softball that's or something like that. So let's talk about that. When we have these hailstones with different sizes, or different shapes, is the size measured like the farthest diameter that you can get on the hailstone?
Yeah, so when we take measurements in the field, we take 3 measurements of a hailstone. So you're going to take the maximum diameter, your minimum diameter, and an intermediate diameter to really get the whole surface of the hailstone. And you can also see that these are 3D prints of hailstone. So we also do 3D scans of stones that are in the field. And it is really crazy to show people how non-spherical some of these stones really are. All the lobes and spikes that you see on them. I've got 2 others here just to kind of show. Stone was found in Nebraska. It's a bit smaller, but you can see more spikiness on this guy. And then sometimes we'll scan some smaller stones, and even the smaller stones, a lot of them are more spherical, but sometimes you get these really funky shaped little guys. This kind of reminds me of Wilson from Castaway in a way.
Yeah.
But they have these really funky lobes and spikes associated with them. So it's not always your spherical hailstones that fall.
So how do these spikes and different shapes, how does that impact the damage on the ground?
So when we're talking about asphalt shingles, mostly here at the lab, we do spherical hailstones when we do impact testing of materials. We have branched out and tried doing impact testing for stones that look like this, where they have those lobes off the edge of them. And we've noticed that if any of these spikes hit directly on your asphalt shingles, they will cause breaches, which are cracks and tears in them, which can lead to water entry issue. Not to say that a spherical hailstone won't cause breaches or dents or tears, but these for sure, if they get hit the right way on your shingles, they will cause cracks. And it is very hard to determine if a spike will hit your roof directly because they tumble in the atmosphere. Even for us, we could not predict whether a spike on one of the hailstones that we were shooting or impacting was actually going to hit the right way that we wanted it to on the asphalt shingle panels.
Brenna, I think it's interesting you're talking about the different size, shape, hail that actually happens in the real world. And so it may cause our listeners to say, hang on a second. So hail is often falling in the spring and summer when we have warm conditions on the ground. Hail is basically, you know, these balls of ice falling out of the sky. So how in the world do we know that? Don't these things melt? IBHS has done amazing work with your hail research. I know you have a field team out there. What is the field team doing, and how do they collect these types of hail to really know what's happening out there?
Yeah, so we have our lead meteorologist, Dr. Ian Giamenco, who is at looking at the weather, checking radar, and when we go to deploy on a storm, we have a bunch of different instruments that we use to take measurements on the ground, so we get that ground truth compared to radar data. And we use what's called impact astrometers. So we have a fleet of 24 of these. They're a 1x1 square kind of aluminum plate. And we stick those guys out on the side of the road, maybe about a quarter of a mile to about a mile and a half apart from one another. And it's in front of the storm about maybe 30 minutes before a storm would pass over, and really to get the swath data of all the hail that's falling. So it'll give us the hail size, the concentration, along the duration of that storm when it's passed over the road. Now, post the storm, when we go back and collect those distrometers, we will do physical measurements of any hail that's left on the ground. And like you said, usually they occur, hailstorms usually occur in warmer environments. The air does cool pretty quickly when hailstorms occur. So some of the time there is hail still left on the ground. If it's smaller, it may melt a little quicker. But if there is any hail left on the ground, we do physical measurements. So like I mentioned, the diameters, the max, minimum, and intermediate diameter we take. We do, we get the mass of each of hailstones. We tend to take about 15 to 20 per location that we're stopped at. We also do, like I said, 3D scanning of stones if they have a really funky shape to them or if they're large. And we do crush tests. So what that is just with a clamp that you would get at Lowe's or Home Depot, really anywhere, any hardware store, and we stick a load cell on it. And that tells us the compressive strength of hailstones, because they're are actually harder hailstones and very, very soft hailstones too. So we take those measurements in the field. And something else that we started doing 2 years ago was taking asphalt shingle panels into the field with us and deploying them next to our impact astrometers. So we have astrometer data and we have real asphalt shingle damage data from the field that we can compare back to our laboratory testing.
Brennan, so the distrometer, is it's really recording the impact of what hail hit, like on that? Is it almost like a two-dimensional plate or something like that that's out there by the roadside?
It's got four faces on it, and there's a piezoelectric sensor that sits up at the top underneath the plate, and taking the vibration of every single impact, and I think we can resolve up to 0.05 of a second, so it can take a lot of impacts, and we'll convert that using like area under the curve and the calibrations that we do to these distrometers prior to going out there. We take those voltages that it gives us, and we can back it up to a size of hailstone.
So your field team's out there deploying distrometers. Do they often try to like visually observe hail as well, or are they more trying to deploy distrometers and other instruments and then like get out of the way of the hail?
We try to get out of the way of the hail. We would like to visualize it, but if we do, it's at a safe distance. We don't try to put ourselves or our vehicles in harm's way by any means.
Sure, that makes sense. Brenna, I have so many questions because this is so fascinating. I mean, here is this hazard that is not well understood. You're out there on the ground trying to collect data. You mentioned that you're really trying to get field data and real world data that, you know, as opposed to just using radar data. What do you see as far as the difference of what radar products might suggest is happening? We know some of these NOAA products like the MRMS radar, they'll actually do estimate of hail swath and hail size. How does that match up with what you're often seeing on the ground?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, mesh and some of those radar products, they're just not quite there yet. Sometimes we do see a difference in hail estimates. Sometimes it's overestimating what hail is actually going to fall. And so actually, one of the things that we're trying to do to help with that is understanding environmental characteristics of hailstones. And this year, when we typically do our hail field campaign, hail field project, where we go out and we get these physical measurements, This year is actually something new. We are a part of this larger field campaign that's called Ice Chip. It's an NSF-funded campaign, and it's involving 15 different organizations, including us and a couple universities as well. And really, we're all out there collectively to do just that. One of our goals is to help with radar signatures and help with warnings and also just understanding the science behind hail better.
Sure. And that's great, having those field teams. It sounds like it's a combination of research, but then also having different personnel from different organizations and universities that are out there that can help collect the field work.
Right. Yeah. Because we're all going to have different tasks. So for us, IBHS, we're mainly focused. We're one of the ground truth teams. So we're getting those physical measurements on the ground. There's other teams that are more focused on radar and air measurements, atmospheric measurements, while we're focusing on the ground.
In just a few minutes, we are going to talk about the amazing research lab that y'all have that tests wind, hail, all kinds of things in a controlled environment. I think our listeners are going to be really interested in that. But before we do that, we're going to do our favorite segment of the GeoTrek podcast, Weathered Wisdom, where we have guests share really an impactful weather event that stuck with them. It could be something that influenced you professionally, something that impacted you personally, just something that you observed as far as extreme weather that stayed with you. Sarah, let's start with you and then we'll come back to Brenna. Sarah, what's your weathered wisdom? What's a weather event? We know you're a meteorology student. You're passionate about the weather. I mean, what's a weather event that really hooked you and you said, man, this is what I want to do for a profession?
Yeah, so I believe Brenna's heard me tell this story already, but in December of 2023, there was a severe thunderstorm at my home in Richmond, and I was home for winter break, and our backyard was struck by lightning. So that caused damage for weeks beyond the incident, the date of the incident. We had a tree through one of our windows in our house. We had a tree fall on my mom's sunroof of her car. We had power out. And we had appliances that just kept breaking days after that had happened. So the impact lasted, and that was, I had never experienced anything like that before. And I feel like that was a really rare occurrence, but.
So it sounds like substantial wind damage, but also a lightning strike. And were you there when all this hit?
I wasn't there. I was in town, but I was at a different house.
What was it like for you to get home and see what happened from a December thunderstorm nonetheless, right?
Yeah, my parents had texted and explained it over text, and so I was already really surprised to hear that. And they had explained the damage that had been done, but when I walked through the door and I saw the shattered window and I saw everything that had come down in the backyard, I was shocked. And we had just adopted a new dog, too. So I was really glad that he wasn't outside and that everybody was okay. But it was really shocking to see with my own eyes.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, a few things that stand out to me, isn't it different when a storm hits your home, right? I mean,
yes.
It's not just a random house. It's your house.
Yeah.
It sounds like that had a big impact on your family. And also really interesting there, a December severe thunderstorm. And we get this idea that thunderstorms happen in the spring and summer. We have a lot of examples, the Mayfield, Kentucky tornado outbreak, things like this that happened in December. So that's a good reminder to our listeners, even though we have seasons for thunderstorms and wildfire and other things, they can happen out of season too, right?
Yeah, anytime.
Thanks, Sarah, for sharing that. Brenna, what about you? What's your weathered wisdom? What's a weather event that stands out to you professionally or personally that really influenced you?
So I think I actually have two. But I'll try to go quick at them. So the first one, it was Hurricane Helene, and it didn't impact myself directly, but being in the Charlotte area, we have a lot of friends that live over in Boone, and I know people that went there for college, and we go over to the mountains all the time for hiking and to visit the area. So that storm hit home for myself and a lot of close friends of mine around the area, just because it's just so close. And secondly is actually the Rock Hill hail event that occurred. Rock Hill is about 30 minutes south of Charlotte. And I remember the time I was actually living I had a townhouse in Fort Mill, which is 15 minutes outside of Rock Hill, closer to Charlotte. But I actually wasn't at my house at the time. I was up in the city for a baseball game, and I remember seeing the radar. This was over the weekend, but I remember seeing the radar of this big storm coming, smaller storm coming through. And I was noticing a lot of M-pings on my radar where it was picking up hail and some that were larger. And I was like, oh, that is not what I would have expected here in like South Carolina. And we actually had a couple folks of ours go out to Rock Hill area after the storm and do a post-event survey, and just seeing all the damage from the homes was pretty crazy. I mean, we see roof damage. We do a lot of testing with roofs, but then just seeing the siding of houses that were obliterated from this hail was so unfortunate. I was thankful for me, the storm got so close to my neighborhood. I know if I was home and this storm actually did cross over my house, I would have had a lot of damage to my house. My car would have been damaged. So I'm thankful for that, but it also just very unfortunate for the folks that were in Rock Hill at the time. And some of the researchers and folks that work here do live in Rock Hill. So it was crazy to see that damage.
Brenna, you mentioned damage to siding, and I'm glad you brought that up. You know, when I follow weather news, there was a big hail event in Norman, Oklahoma a few years ago. And I remember reading on social media, they said like every south facing, or maybe it was east facing, it was a certain direction. And like all of the windows on that direction of these houses were blown out. And it got me thinking, wow, we typically think of hail as a roof problem, or at least I do. But it seems like if it's coming in from an angle, it could also impact siding and maybe windows as well, right?
Yeah, so one of our researchers here is actually creating what's called a wind-driven hail probe. And it's something similar to what our distrometers do, but it's supposed to capture hail at an angle so we can understand more of the wind-driven aspect when it comes to hail because of a lot of siding damage that we see. And back to some of the stuff that we test in the lab, we do some siding testing as well to investigate those.
Well, Brenna, you mentioned the lab. I want to get in to hear more about this. And then we want to go back to Sarah. Sarah, I know you did an internship with IBHS in their hail lab, and we really want to hear what you did with that. So let's start off with talking about this lab. We've already talked about the amazing field work that IBHS is doing out in severe thunderstorms, but you also do controlled testing back in the lab for hail and other hazards. Tell us about this controlled lab you have and what you can learn from that.
Yeah. So since we're talking about hail, I'll start off with our hail lab. So our hail lab is mostly comprised of doing what we call small laboratory testing. So we have smaller pieces of a building, mostly like I talked about, is roofing materials. We do asphalt shingles, which is the most common type in the United States. We also branch out and do metal or tile or synthetic composite. So we do a little bit of testing on those in a smaller scale. We also, like I said, do siding testing as well of different types of siding materials, what's underneath it. And then we also have our hail lab, we also have our wind chamber, which is really what stands out for us because it is so large. It is a 6-story concrete chamber, and the whole back wall of it is kind of like the jet engines you'd see on an airplane. There's 105 of those across the back wall. And when we crank those things up at full speed, we can get up to about 130 miles an hour inside the chamber, which is absolutely amazing. And we can recreate hurricane hurricane traces inside of our chamber with full-scale buildings. So we will build a full one-story house, or we've done demonstrations on a 2-story house before. So we have this was one of our garage door testing that we did a couple years ago. So we'll test different aspects of the house. And like I said, this one was particularly on garage door testing.
That's amazing. For our listeners, if you're not following online, we're actually seeing videos from the wind chamber of houses and how they're impacted, how the garage door might have impacted the impact of the winds. And and even inside, how you're seeing some wind-driven rain come inside. This is amazing. The camera work on this is spectacular.
Yes, the capabilities of the chamber are awesome. Like I said, the full-scale testing that we can do. We also have, we also use the chamber for fire testing as well. So we have what called ember generators, and that's exactly what they do. They generate embers, and they we turn the fans on a little low, about maybe 30 to 50 miles an hour, and we blow those embers towards a structure, whether it's inside the chamber or outside the chamber in the back. So that's where we typically do our wildfire testing.
And Brenna, sometimes you'll set up two houses next to each other that are built or designed differently. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. So we've done a couple testings with two different buildings. One of them was our was a commercial building where it was one was built stronger, one was built more common. And then we have also our residential buildings that I love to show people it. Just the visuals so cool. And it was for our fortified program. A couple years ago, we did this, I think in 2010, where we same thing with the commercial buildings. We built one house to our fortified standard, which is more of an enhanced coating standard. And then we took a typical, I think, inland building code standard and turn the fans on full speed, and you'll see the typical home just blow away right off its stilts, right off the foundation.
Brenna, back to hail. So what are there any major findings that y'all found by testing buildings in the hail lab? You know, shooting hailstones at buildings. Is there any type of building material, types of shingles, type of design, like some major things that stands out to y'all when you've tested this?
I think one of the things that stood out to me more is, I know we were talking about some of the larger hail, where people typically think that large hail is really what's going to cause an issue and cause damage to their house. But one of the some of the research that we're doing currently is actually on smaller hail and the high concentrations of it, and actually seeing the damage potential that smaller hail can have on your house and on your roof in particular. We're doing a mild simulation of subsevere hail on asphalt shingles, and we do notice that it is mainly a granule loss problem, but age is such a factor in the materials. It's not when they're just brand new. We test these when they've been aged for a couple years, and then we impact them with a higher concentration of subsevere hail, and we notice that the damage could be exacerbated just from these small hailstones if you have a large hail event in the future.
Sure.
The damage is going to be like could be 10 times as bad in the future.
So it sounds like there's almost a cumulative effect, like almost stress on the shingles or stress on the roof. Like you've been hit by two or three small hail events that mm-hmm. could then change what happens when a large hail event comes. Is that right?
Absolutely. And when you're losing those granules are on your roof for a reason. They're not just there to look pretty. You know, they're protecting the asphalt that's underneath. When that asphalt is exposed to the sun, it's exposed to UV, it just becomes more brittle. And if a large hail event were to occur later on, that's going to lead to dents and tears, and then could be a water entry problem as well.
For sure. No, that's so exciting. And look at those are amazing insights. When you refer to subsevere hail, you're also talking about hail less than 1 inch in diameter. Is that right?
Right. So when we're doing this testing, we test with 3/4 inch hail. We also do 1 inch hail as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Really interesting to hear what you're doing in the field. Fascinating to see what you're doing in the lab. And let's talk now about Aging Farm. I know you mentioned that. I know, Sarah, you did an internship with IBHS where you were working at Aging Farm. Maybe, Brenna, if you want to introduce what Aging Farm is, and then, Sarah, if you could tell us about your experience with IBHS, what you did on your internship and what you learned.
Sure. So I'll just give a brief overview of what the Aging Farm is. And it's these huts of shingles, really. They sit outside our farm here, or they sit outside our lab here in Richburg, South Carolina, and we just let these shingles or any type of roofing material that we're investigating, we let them age for a period of time or naturally weather for a period of time. And some are going to be out there for up to 20 years. So what we'll do is we'll have 4 huts for a single product. And every 5 years, we will, what's called, harvest that material. We'll bring it in the lab, and we will do performance testing against hail, wind, and wildfire to see how those aged products fare to severe weather.
Wow, that is fascinating. And again, you mentioned the age of your roof, the age of these materials can have a huge impact. Sarah, tell us about what did you do as an intern with Aging Farm? I mean, it sounds like a very interesting college internship. What did you do and what did you learn?
Yeah, so the Aging Farm was my main focus over the summer and the impacts of those roofs that had been harvested. So the ones that I was looking at for hail damage had been aging for the last 10 years. And so I got to observe and be a part of the process of impacting those with hailstones and then using imaging to see the types of damage that occurred and how severe that damage was. And I found it really interesting how Brenna earlier mentioned hard hail and soft hail. And I kind of noticed a pattern that there would be specific types of damage that were more prone to happen with soft hail, like granule loss, and then more other types of damage that were associated with the harder hail. I was also surprised to see the performance after just 10 years, because I know my parents mentioned that they have a 25-year roof, and some of the damage on the shingles was really severe after just 10 years. So I can't imagine what that would look like 5-10 years down the line.
Yeah, that's interesting too, how specifically you're testing. You're like, this is, you know, these shingles are this age and we're going to test these different size and hard hail, soft hail. It sounds like you're really breaking this down into nuance. And that's really interesting too, to see that just 10 years of aging can make such a big difference. Do y'all have a general recommendation of how often people should get a new roof if they want to mitigate hail damage?
So that's a tough question to answer. We know that with our aging farms, the reliability tends to go down after that 10-year mark, especially when it comes to severe weather. You know, we saw degradation from our aging farm here, like that are at most. We saw degradation here, like Sarah mentioned, at the 10-year mark. But those, if you're in a mild environment, you may not have to worry about it right now, because those shingles are okay. But when you're in an environment that sees severe weather all the time, I know in the DFW area, sometimes within a 10-year time span, you may be replacing your roof 3 times. Depends on the storm, or it depends on how the season, I guess, how active that season and how much hail you're getting. But it also depends on, like I said, the climatology, what area of the country you're in, how much hail you're seeing in a given year, and then the material on your roof. There are some materials that may be better than others. You have impact-resistant shingles that tend to be better than conventional shingles. That's what they're meant to do, is to be impact resistant from debris and hail. And then you have your metal and synthetic composite, which also that depends on the cost, how much you're willing to spend, because the metal and synthetic composite, they are a bit more expensive, but they could potentially have more durability. And we are still continuing to do testing on some of those materials too.
Something I really picked up on this podcast today, there's so much nuance, right? Like it depends. For some of these questions, there's not just one straight answer. It depends where you live, depends what you face, it depends the type of house, the type of materials. I know our listeners are going to love this podcast. We have a lot of professionals as well that work in insurance industry and different industries that are going to learn a lot from y'all. I wish we could go on for hours. This is fascinating. We're almost out of time, but what resources could you point our listeners to if they want to dig in deeper, if they want to be like, okay, I want to read these reports from IBHS, I want to learn more about this, where can people go to find out more?
IBHS.org has everything for you. We have specific tabs for wind research, hail research, and fire research as well. And then some of the different reports will be in there as well. I did mention the Rock Hill hail event. We're actually doing a report on that, and that should be coming out on April 14th, which is the 1-year anniversary of the event. So that'll be some claims information combined with some post-damage post-event damage survey in that report. We're also getting into thunderstorm season, severe weather season. So right now we are pushing out our thunderstorm ready guidance. You can find all of those guides at thunderstorm-ready.org. And it really just talks about how to prepare your home prior to thunderstorm season, and really just to start now before we get into the peak season. And if you can, replace your roof, replace your garage door with a wind-rated garage door. We understand that most homeowners may not be ready to do that right now. We know that that's costly. But there are some small things that you can do as well to get yourself prepared when severe weather is coming, like bringing any outdoor furniture inside, getting your cars inside as well so it doesn't become flying debris. But again, you can find all of that information on our website at thunderstorm-ready.org.
I love the focus on preparedness. I know that you're putting a lot of materials out there to help people get ready for a severe weather season. And I know your field teams are getting ready to deploy this spring as well. I may be with GeoTrack. We're often out there as well at documenting severe weather. So we may cross paths, but I think you had mentioned in May, you're going to be out there quite a bit in the Plain States doing hail research, right?
Yes, we will. We will be out there with Ice Chip, as I mentioned. And so we'll be out there mid-May through the end of June. So if you guys are out there, we'd love to meet up and kind of show you the equipment and what we do.
That sounds fantastic. And as we close, I want to give both of you a chance to just share one last take-home point, one last thing you'd want to share with our audience. Let's start with you, Sarah. What's one last thing you'd want to share with our audience about hail or the importance of preparing for it?
I would just say from what I learned over the summer, Brenna mentioned earlier that different roofing materials may work better for different types of severe weather. So I think it's just important to know what type of weather you're more prone to based on the area that you live in, and maybe be aware of that when you're buying a roof or the next time you have to replace your roof.
Those are great insights there. We really appreciate that. And Brenna, what's one last take-home message you'd want to share with our audience today?
It's just that hail is so damaging, and we see that just from the beginning of our podcast, where we talked about how much damage hail can actually cause in severe weather, and really to get homeowners to pay more attention to this hazard and really do what they can to prepare themselves, prepare their homes. We don't want to see people losing their homes, and we don't want to see people losing money over all the damage that these storms can cause. And we have a lot of tips of how to get yourself prepared and action items that you can do with your home, including, like I said, the Thunderstorm Ready Guide, and maybe taking some fortified steps as well with your roof and getting a sealed roof deck, which will really, really help when the time comes in severe weather.
Brenna and Sarah, fantastic insights. What I love about this podcast, you're helping to empower our listeners that there are things they can do on their own home to prepare for hail and severe weather. Really appreciate you taking time to come with the podcast. We know there will be hail this year. You know, sometimes with hurricanes, we say we're not sure. With hail, we know it's going to be out there. And I think a lot of people out there are going to be better prepared because of the work that you and your team at IBHS are doing to help prepare people for hail. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Thank you. Really appreciate it, hail.
I think the biggest thing I learned on this episode was the amount of detail IBHS puts into their research. I was frankly amazed by this. For example, I didn't realize that they were deploying instrumentation to actually measure hail impacts in the field, as well as measuring and scanning hailstones. In the lab, I thought it was really interesting that they're measuring the impact of both soft and hard hail and looking at details of materials impacted. A lot of this takes long-term vision. For example, the aging farm exposes roofing materials to the elements for years to lab test how exposure to weather over long periods of time changes the vulnerability of these materials. This work is so effective because it simulates real-world conditions, and it's impressive because this isn't research that you can just spin up on a whim. These materials are left to age in the elements for more than a decade, which shows a commitment to long-term research. Thank you so much for listening. Your support has helped us become a top-ranked podcast on the topic of natural disasters. A huge thank you as well to our GeoTrek production team, Jeremiah Long, Ashley Anderson, and Braxton Brown. Be sure to leave a review and subscribe on your favorite listening platform to make sure you don't miss any upcoming episodes. I'm your host, Hurricane Hal, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.